Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the April 5th, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week has Donald Trump standing in the foreground in his traditional blue suit, red tie. He's got a smile on his face. With his right hand, he is removing a surgical mask. With his left hand, he's giving a thumbs up. In the background, we see a group of hospital workers. They're in full COVID gear. And with the help of a forklift, they are moving orange body bags into the back of a tractor trailer, reminiscent of those during the COVID pandemic that they used when the morgues were full. The headline is, "Better Off? Trump's claim that the U.S. was thriving 4 years ago." We get that story in the controversy of the week, but the first main story is also about Mr. Trump. Trump rages as hush money trial goes ahead. What happened? Donald Trump scored a victory in a Manhattan courtroom this week as an appeals court slashed the size of a potentially crippling bond payment. But an hour later, took a blow in a second courtroom as a judge ruled that the first of four pending criminal cases against him will start trial April 15th. Trump had faced a deadline to either pay a $464 million verdict against him in a civil fraud trial, in which he was found to have massively overinflated the value of his properties, or post a $454 million bond while appealing. Trump's lawyers said he couldn't secure a bond so large, and New York Attorney General Letitia James signaled that if he failed, she'd start seizing his real estate holdings. But Trump was thrown a lifeline when the appeals court reduced the bond to $175 million and gave him 10 more days to post it. "We'll put it up very quickly and we'll win the case," Trump said. He scored another coup when his Truth Social platform went public, and its valuation rose to $7.8 billion, though he can't sell or borrow against his 58% stake in the company for at least 6 months. In the second case, New York Judge Juan Merchan denied Trump's bid to delay a trial on charges that he falsified business records to cover up a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election. Merchan later imposed a limited gag order barring Trump from discussing witnesses and others involved in the case. On social media, Trump called Merchan a hater who suffers from Trump derangement syndrome and took aim at his daughter, a Democratic political consultant. "How can this be allowed?" Trump wrote. What the editorial said: "The bond reduction is the fair and correct outcome," said the Washington Post. "Whatever one thinks of Trump, every defendant deserves due process, including the right to an appeal. Even billionaires can't easily cough up hundreds of millions in cash, and if James seized his assets and the appeals court later overturned the penalty, the damage would be irreversible. Trump may ultimately have to pay up in full. But in the meantime, allowing him to exhaust his legal options without pushing him toward bankruptcy is only just." It's deliciously appropriate that Trump, a serial tax grifter, will see his Stormy Daniels trial start on tax day, said the New York Daily News, as well as allegedly violating New York tax law in that case with his sleazy payout. He's also accused of breaking state and federal campaign laws. But at its core, this trial is about whether the man who was once the most powerful in the world, and may yet be again, can be held to the same standard of justice as an ordinary New Yorker. what the columnist said. In a bizarre twist, the very day Trump's business empire was supposed to be in mortal peril because the single greatest day on, became the single greatest day on record for his personal wealth, said Tom Maloney in Bloomberg. The skyrocketing value of his Truth Social shares shot his fortune up to an estimated $6.5 billion, landing Trump among the world's 500 richest people for the first time. But his day in Merchant's courtroom couldn't have gone worse, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. Merchant upbraided Trump's lawyer for overreach and ruled repeatedly against his bids to exclude potentially damaging evidence and witnesses, such as Daniels. Trump should be quaking in his boots. Trump caught a break from the appeals court, but so did President Biden and the Democrats, said W. James Antle III in CNN.com. They've sidestepped the angry backlash from voters that would have followed any effort to take over Trump's real estate. The sight of bailiffs entering Trump Tower or another property would only have boosted Trump's claims he's being victimized by partisan prosecutors, helping rally sympathetic voters to his side. The head-spinning back-to-back judgments offer a preview of the chaos that lies ahead, said Maggie Haberman in the New York Times. In a few weeks, a former president and current presidential candidate will face a criminal trial for the first time in history. Trump will campaign even as he spends 4 days a week in court and do his best to leverage the cases to his political advantage. Already he's seeking to paint himself as a martyr, sharing a note from a fan who compared his legal troubles to the persecution of Jesus. Nothing about the months until Election Day will be easy, linear, or normal for Trump or the nation. And the controversy of the week, Biden versus Trump. Was the U.S. better off 4 years ago? Even for Donald Trump, this is so weird, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. With the GOP nomination now secured, Trump has chosen to begin his general election campaign by reviving Ronald Reagan's famous 1980 appeal to voters. Are you better off than you were 4 years ago? He's hammering that message in speeches and social media posts as though it's a slam dunk winner, oblivious to the fact that the spring of 2020 is a time most of us would prefer to forget. COVID was ripping across the nation and our economy had collapsed. Terrified Americans, 22 million of them newly unemployed, were isolated at home, obsessively washing their groceries, and watching their chaotic then-president veer between denialism, magical thinking, and touting quack cures for a virus that would go on to kill a million of us. Trump's bizarre appeal to pandemic nostalgia is a gift to Democrats, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com. At a donor event last week, Biden thanked Trump for his question before reeling off a litany of that spring's horrors. Mobile morgues on the streets, nurses wearing garbage bags for protection, an unhinged president musing aloud about bleach injections. Biden would surely prefer to run a forward-thinking campaign, but he can only benefit by detailing how catastrophically bad things were when Trump was in office. Sorry, Democrats, but voters agree with the former president, said Antonio Fins in the Palm Beach Post. In a new CBS News YouGov poll, 46% of Americans rated Trump's term in office as excellent or good, compared with only 33% for Biden's. 65% said the economy was good under Trump, versus a mere 38% for Biden. Trump critics are perhaps being too literal about Trump's better off question, said Ashley Parker and Hannah Knowles in the Washington Post. No one's pining to relive the nightmares of spring 2020. It's true. But as those sharp memories fade, focus groups of voters show that many Americans have discovered a gauzy nostalgia for the Trump years. Those warmer feelings are centered on grocery prices, interest rates, gas prices, all lower under Trump, and the other pocketbook issues that so often decide elections. Don't facts matter? Asked Michael Tomosky in the New Republic. Even if we set aside Trump's disastrous pandemic dereliction, a 2021 study estimated some 400,000 U.S. lives could have been saved with a better federal response. Biden's economic record beats Trump's, and it's not even close. A record 11 million new jobs were added in Biden's first 2 years, more than double Trump's 4.5 million. And while inflation has been punishing, wages have risen too, unemployment is near historic lows, and the stock market is hitting all-time highs. Biden's problem, and the good news for Trump, is that we don't want to remember how we felt 4 years ago, said clinical psychiatrist George McCary and Richard A. Friedman in The Atlantic. The spring of 2020 was an overwhelming and painful experience for most Americans, and we have tried our best as a nation and as individuals to pretend it never happened. Trying to forget traumatic memories is a natural human response, and even, to a degree, healthy. But all that unprocessed grief and shock is now resurfacing as a kind of free-floating sadness and anger that makes it hard to rationally assess the state of our lives and our country, let alone to make good choices moving forward. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for bullies after a British study found that 10-year-olds who exhibit aggressive behavior on the playground go on to earn higher salaries than their peers at 46. Co-author Amelia Del Bono said schools might want to reconsider discipline in light of the findings. It was a good week for adulterers after New York Assemblyman Charles Levine introduced a bill to repeal the state's rarely enforced 1907 ban on marital infidelity. The ban doesn't serve as a deterrent, said Levine. It's a celebration of someone's concept of their own morality. It was a good week for Weird Al Yankovic, whose half-century career of hit-or-miss parody songs will be the subject of a college course this fall at Vermont State University. Professor Brian Warwick says Yankovic's oeuvre provides students a great avenue to start studying the 20th century. But it was a bad week for victimhood after John Hinckley Jr., who shot President Ronald Reagan in a 1981 assassination attempt, complained that music venues keep rescinding offers to let him perform his original songs. I'm a victim of cancel culture, said Hinckley, 68. It was a bad week for Cowboy States after Seattle Mariners pitcher Logan Gilbert publicly aligned himself with the online conspiracy theory that Wyoming does not exist. Think about it, said Gilbert on TikTok. Have you ever met somebody from Wyoming? Nobody has. Finally, it was a bad week for celibacy after the organizers of this year's Paris Olympics axed a COVID-era ban on athlete intimacy and announced the Olympic Village would be stocked with 300,000 condoms. Every resident will have what they need, said Village Director Laurent Michaud. This week's briefing is titled The Great Housing Crunch. High prices and a lack of supply are putting the dream of home ownership out of reach for millions of Americans. How severe is the housing crisis? Economists estimate the U.S. has anywhere from 2 million to 7 million fewer homes than it needs. To fill that gap and to keep up with population growth, at least 1.5 million homes would have to be built every year, a benchmark the country hasn't hit since 2008. With demand far outpacing supply, prices have skyrocketed beyond the reach of many Americans, especially the young. The median existing single-family home now sells for $384,500, up 6% year over year and about 88% in a decade. While the age of the typical first-time home buyer has gone from 31 in 2014 to 35 today. Rent has also become more expensive, climbing nearly 30% since the start of the pandemic to a nationwide average of $1,959 a month. The fast rising cost of housing in part explains the U.S.'s surging homeless population, which climbed 12% in 2023 to a record 653,000 people, and why so many lower-income Americans have not felt the benefit of the booming post-pandemic economy. After 26-year-old community college employee Katie Salmonson lost her $900 a month apartment in Ellenville, New York last year, she and her family had to settle for a cramped $2,000 a month trailer. "I just needed a roof over my kid's head," Salmonson said. "It just makes me want to cry." Why is there such a shortage of homes? The roots go back to the 2008 financial crisis. As home prices sank during the Great Recession, so did the construction of new housing units, with the U.S. adding fewer single-family homes in the 2010s than in any decade since the 1960s. When the pandemic hit, that shortage of new builds combined with near-zero interest rates, supply chain snarls, and an exodus from big cities to send home prices skyrocketing. Economists thought prices might fall when the Federal Reserve hiked interest rates to curb inflation, which in turn helped push 30-year mortgage rates above 8% in 2023. Instead, owners held on to homes they'd refinanced at super low rates, and competition for the limited number of properties on the market remained fierce, propping up prices. The market has only been made hotter by the growing presence of institutional investors, which sometimes snap up entire neighborhoods to flip or rent out. Such investors were behind a quarter of all single-family purchases in June 2023. "Ordinary people are bidding against billionaires of America," said Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat from Oregon. "It's driving up rents, and it's driving up the home prices." Is the problem worse in some areas? It's especially severe in major coastal cities, which have long failed to build enough supply to house new arrivals. In the San Francisco Bay Area, where the median single-family home now sells for $1.1 million, only one new single-family housing unit permit was issued for every 21 new jobs created last July. The nationwide historical average is one permit for every two new jobs. But the housing shortage is no longer just a big city problem, in part because of the flood of city dwellers who moved to the suburbs, rural communities, and affordable metros during the pandemic. Montana added some 40,000 residents from 2020 to 2022, but only 8,700 new homes. That disparity caused average home prices to spike 60% to more than $450,000. Medium home prices in Utah, another state that saw a COVID-era boom in arrivals, now top 500,000, and four out of five Salt Lake City homes are unaffordable for an average earner there. The housing shortage has become a crisis in red parts of the country, rural parts of the country, said former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Sean Donovan, in places where it's never been an issue. What can be done? The YIMBY movement, YIMBY, short for Yes in My Backyard, argues that communities need to scrap NIMBY, not in my backyard, policies that make it hard to build apartment buildings, townhouses, and neighborhoods filled with smaller, more affordable houses. About 75% of urban and suburban residential land is zoned exclusively for single-family houses, and some suburbs mandate minimum lot sizes and even minimum house height requirements. Supporters of those rules say they protect a community's character, an argument YIMBY say has racist and classist implications. YIMBYs have made some headway. At least five states, along with cities such as Minneapolis, Austin, and Salt Lake City, have recently voted to curtail exclusively single-family zoning. But there has been resistance. New York Governor Kathy Hochul last year abandoned a plan to mandate the building of more housing units near transit hubs following a suburban backlash. One of the tricky parts of housing politics is that a lot of Americans sincerely believe that their city needs more housing, said Salim Firth of George Mason University. But are then unenthusiastic about any specific housing development on their street? Is zoning reform the only remedy? By itself, it won't solve the housing crisis. Construction costs remain high. The price of materials jumped nearly 30% from 2020 to 2022. And the home building industry is short some 700,000 workers. Thickets of regulations, some arbitrary, but many that protect residents' health and safety, can mean the journey from project proposal to completion lasts years. And simply loosening restrictions will not guarantee that housing will be built where demand is highest and with access to basic services such as municipal sewer and water systems or schools and hospitals. When it comes to tackling the housing shortage, said urban planner Alexander Van Hoffman, laws against single-family zoning are but the first steps in a long march. And time for a few of the best columns of the week. Start with one from Rich Lowry at National Review. Less work would mean less wealth. Karl Marx would be proud, said Rich Lowry, in his latest fanciful proposal for creating a workers' utopia. Bernie Sanders, the socialist Vermont senator, has proposed that employers be mandated to move from a 40-hour to a 32-hour work week with no reduction in pay. Cutting the work week to 4 days, Sanders said, would reduce the stress level in our country and allow Americans to enjoy a better quality of life. This notion perfectly captures Sanders' economic illiteracy. If everyone worked 20% less, GDP would decline by about 20%, causing a dramatic drop in available wealth. Now, it's true that Americans work more hours than people in many other countries, such as France, but the average net disposable household income in France is $34,375 a year, compared with $51,147 in the U.S. Do most Americans want to become poorer in exchange for more leisure time? Doubtful. If we could reduce work hours by 20% with no impact on our standard of living, why stop there? How about a 2-day week? It would certainly benefit the country if Sanders spent 5 days a week in an easy chair and less time promoting badly ludicrous ideas. This column comes from the UK. Why you can't say widow now. The woke generation is more fragile than we knew, said Celia Walden. Not only do they faint at any word that carries a whiff of unpleasantness, but they can also even find fault with adorable, fluffy guinea pigs. In the new inclusive language guide that Lloyds Bank has just issued for its 57,000 employees, guinea pig is listed as a term to be avoided because vegan colleagues may be offended by a reference to animal experimentation. Headless chicken also can't be used because it invokes violence, while sold down the river is a term from the American slave trade. The most baffling of the banned words is widow. Lloyds calls it unnecessarily vivid and says it could spur memories of traumatic loss. How should staff now refer to this unlucky breed of women, you may well ask? Lloyds suggests separated, a word that means something entirely different and is guaranteed to generate sitcom-worthy misunderstandings. Is Scottish Widows, the venerable life insurance firm owned by Lloyds, now to be renamed Scottish Separatist? The whole usage guide essentially invites us to imagine a cowardly new world without pain, hardship, or loss. Yet we need the bad to appreciate the good. Living in a sanitized world where any form of extreme emotion is dampened down to nothing, now that would be traumatic. This is an international column from India. Sparring with China high in the Himalayas. China is picking a pointless fight with India, said Shishir Gupta. It lashed out last week after India inaugurated a new highway tunnel 13,000 feet up in the Himalayas that links the northeastern states of Assam and Arunachal Pradesh near the disputed border with China. China repeated its unfounded cartographical claims, first levied during British colonial rule over India, that Arunachal Pradesh should properly be considered South Tibet and therefore Chinese territory. We require the Indian side to cease any action that may complicate the boundary question, China's defense ministry said, adding menacingly that the Chinese military would resolutely defend national sovereignty. But this is just bluster. China has gone downhill in recent years with the real estate crisis and high youth unemployment, so it's trying to distract people by scent marking its territorial claims. India won't take the bait. China may complain, but India will keep building whatever we want on our own land. Yet the Sila Tunnel isn't just another infrastructure project, said Marusha Musafar. Cutting a path deep underneath the Himalayas, it will allow India to move troops around near the largely ill-defined 2,100-mile border without China seeing. India and China fought a war over this long-standing boundary dispute in 1962, when China briefly occupied Arunachal Pradesh before withdrawing its forces back to what both sides call the line of actual control. Now both countries are nuclear powers, and the issue is no closer to being settled. The conflict flared up again in 2020, when skirmishes further west in the Himalayas killed at least 20 Indian soldiers and 4 Chinese. Since then, to fortify India's stance, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has gone on a building spree, constructing bridges, tunnels, and airfields near the border. China, meanwhile, has built model villages near the border and altered its rules on troop movements in the area. The timing of the tunnel's unveiling is suspicious, said the Global Times in an editorial. Modi is running for re-election later this month, and he may be deliberately stoking conflict at the border to rally Indians around the flag. But using border and security issues as a magic weapon to gain votes and popularity is like dancing on the edge of a knife. Modi is risking serious consequences that could endanger the peace of the entire region and cause immeasurable losses to India. Modi should also beware accepting U.S. support in this matter, said Zhang Shusang in China Daily. Washington rashly waded into the dispute last week with a State Department statement reiterating U.S. recognition of so-called Arunachal Pradesh as Indian territory. The U.S. has been wooing Modi for years, trying to lure India into its anti-China alliance. By weighing in on the border, Washington believes it can drive a wedge between China and India. But it could prove costly for India to accept that wedge. China's economy is 5 times bigger than India's, and we have the world's largest military. Does India really want to offend a giant neighbor while all the support it gets from the distant supporter is a statement? Last word, our feature article, The Queen's Endgame. Women's chess champion Lisa Lane captured the national imagination with aggressive play and sharp one-liner, said Stefan Fatsis in Slate. But she couldn't beat the sexism of the 1960s. In May 1961, Lisa Lane was a contestant on the long-running CBS game show, What's My Line? Wearing a dark A-line dress and no jewelry, Lane walked on stage and wrote her name on a chalkboard in neat script. The show's host, John Charles Daly, told the panel of celebrities in tuxedos and evening dresses, on this episode, actor Arlene Francis, Broadway writer A. Burroughs, humorist and publisher Bennett Cerf, and journalist Dorothy Kilgallen, that Lane is self-employed, deals in a service. The panel had to figure out Lane's occupation by asking yes or no questions. Cerf went first. Miss Lane, do your very good looks and youthful charm have any bearing on the service that you perform? Lane said no. Cerf replied, ridiculous, ridiculous. The panelists determined that Lane's job was related to sports. But then they asked whether she wore a costume or worked with animals. Finally, after 10 no's, Daly introduced Lane as the reigning U.S. women's chess champion. Well, John, we were very snobbish, Burroughs said. Because she's so pretty, we ruled out anything intellectual. During her brief and polarizing career in a male-dominated sport in a chauvinistic society, a focus on looks over brains was typically how it went for Lane, who died of cancer on February 28th at age 90 at her home in Kent, New York. When Bobby Fischer was still a brash wunderkind, Lane was a bona fide grown-up media star. In 1961, she was interviewed on the Today Show, was profiled in the New York Times Magazine, and appeared on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Fisher would, too, 11 years later. She was touted as a great American hope against the scary Russians. Lane marketed herself and, in the process, elevated chess profile in America. Disgusted by the game's latent sexism and classism, she criticized its leadership and advocated for equal pay. Then, as quickly as she'd arrived, she all but disappeared from the game. Lisa Lane was an icon and a woman far ahead of her time, said two-time U.S. women's champion Jennifer Shahad, who wrote about Lane in her 2023 book, Chess Queens. Decades before The Queen's Gambit, the 1983 novel by Walter Tevis and hit 2020 Netflix series, Lisa Lane showed the world that chess can be glamorous and that women can be as competitive as men. She got that it wasn't just how you played chess, but also about the people you inspired with your moves. Shortly after the publication of his novel, Tevis told Chess Life magazine that he made no effort to portray any real chess personalities and didn't speak to any women players while researching the book. But there were similarities between the fictional Beth Harmon, played in the adaptation by Anya Taylor-Joy, and the real-life Lane. Both were tempestuous, driven, talented, and unafraid to take on men, the chess establishment, or the Soviets, and both endured turbulent childhoods. Harmon was an orphan. Lane's father left when she was a toddler. Her mother worked as a secretary at a meatpacking company and for a radio station in Philadelphia. Lane and her sister shuttled among homes and boarding schools. She quit high school and cycled through jobs. In a game known for child prodigies and eccentric grinds, Lane's rise was unusual and remarkable. She said she didn't encounter chess until she was a student at Temple University in the spring of 1957 in a coffee house, the Artist's Hut, off Rittenhouse Square. "I was hooked," Lane told Robert Lipsight in Times Magazine story. "It was like being on dope watching the combinations and moves." Lane always said she was 19 when she first played. According to personal records in the 1940 U.S. Census, she actually would have been 23 or 24. "She was fudging a bit along the line," her husband, the retired journalist Neil Hickey, told me. Lane fell into a routine familiar to serious game players. Play a lot, then play some more. One night, she said in the Sports Illustrated story, a high school chess player beat her in a few moves and took her to the Franklin Mercantile Chess Club in Philadelphia. A master level player named Attilio De Camillo agreed to teach her the game. "Lisa improved so fast," Robert Cantwell wrote in SI, "that chess wits said he had hypnotized her, that they were Svengali and Trilby." Lane didn't return to Temple that fall. She took a job at a Philadelphia hospital and studied and played chess. Lane won the city's first women's championship in 1958, was the top woman in the U.S. amateur championship in the spring of 1959, and just 2.5 years after first touching a pawn, won the U.S. women's title that December, dethroning a four-time champ, Gisela Gresser. The Boston Globe's chess columnist wrote that at one of Lane's early tournaments, an open event including both men and women, her games constantly drew the largest gallery. With stunning male chauvinism, one Kibitzer was heard to say in an astonishing tone, "She plays chess like a man. Better than most, I fear, brother." One male player said, "It's hard enough to concentrate on the game with her sitting across the chessboard in a floppy sweater, but on top of that, she's a killer. She plays chess like Pancho Gonzalez plays tennis, always stalking, always aggressive." Lane didn't deny her obsessive drive and volatile temper. "I never hit that guy with an ashtray," she said in SI about an incident in a Philadelphia club. "It hit the table and broke, and a piece must have bounced up and hit him." Nor did she hide her disdain for opponents. "There's no relation between intelligence and chess," she told one reporter. "Some of the dumbest people I know are good chess players." And she never complained about the male writers who described her with a thesaurus of objectifying adjectives. Darkly beautiful, petite, slender, attractive, lissome, comely, shapely. One chess columnist dubbed her America's luscious Lisa Lane. For the SI story, Lane posed on a couch in front of a board, bare-legged in a diaphanous robe. "I love to be in the newspaper," she said. In 2018, she told Emma Bacchiglieri of SI, It didn't bother me. It wasn't like they said I was beautiful and not a good chess player. To Lane, the attention was good for chess and for her own earning potential in a game that offered meager remuneration, especially for women. "For this reason alone, I'm the most important American chess player," Lane told Lipsyte. "People will be attracted to the game by a young, pretty girl. That's why chess should support me. I'm bringing it publicity and, ultimately, money." Lipsyte interviewed Lane after she moved to New York in 1961 to prepare for a tournament in Yugoslavia that would determine a challenger to women's world champion Elisaveta Bykova of the Soviet Union. Lane asked to meet Lipsyte, now 86, over breakfast at 10 p.m. She did a terrific impression for him of the teenage Fischer, who once refused to participate in a tournament with Lane, saying, "Men and women shouldn't play together." Lane zinged back, "Adults and children shouldn't play together." Lane told Lipsyte she wasn't offended at being told she played like a man. "Their egos are involved," she said. "I can understand it. I guess my ego is involved too. I can't stand losing to anybody." She shrugged off the game's inherent boorishness. "I get a lot of love letters from other chess players," she said. "I read them, I laugh, and then I file them. Letters from grandmasters go on top." After moving to New York, Lane received a $1,000 grant from a sports foundation, worked as a part-time editor for a chess magazine, played exhibitions at schools and clubs, made frequent media and TV appearances, including on another game show, To Tell the Truth, and studied Russian so she could read Soviet chess magazines. But at the Challengers Tournament, held in Vrjaka Banja, a Yugoslav mountain resort, Lane finished 12th of 17 players. Next month, she dropped out of a tourney in England because, she said, she was homesick and in love. Lane's withdrawal was big news on both sides of the Atlantic. Among the predictably punny headlines, "Cupid checks chess champ," "Thinking of her knight," and "Chess queen quits. She was only a pawn of love." The boyfriend back home was Neil Hickey, who had written one of the first lathery stories about Lane under the headline "Chess Queen's Gambit," and was later the New York bureau chief for TV Guide and an editor at the Columbia Journalism Review. They would marry in 1969 and were still together at the end of her life. Lane finished second in the 1962 U.S. Women's Championship to Gresser, but was left off a two-player U.S. team for an international competition. Lane complained that she had been blacklisted because other players were sore because I had been getting so much publicity. But U.S. chess officials gave her another reason: money. Gresser, a wealthy Upper East Side patron of the art, in SI's words, and Mary Bain, the 1951 U.S. champ, now ranked only fifth, could afford to pay their own expenses. "Since when did you have to be a millionaire to represent your country in sport?" Lane said. The snub soured her. Lane opened a chess parlor in Greenwich Village called the Queen's Pawn and lived in a studio apartment upstairs. The club was intended, she said, for casual players. "I don't want anything to do with organized chess," Lane told the New York Daily News. She struggled in the 1964 Women's World Championship Challengers Tournament, finishing 12th of 18 players. When the 1966 U.S. Women's Championship in New York offered a prize pool of $600, compared with $6,000 for the men's version, Lane organized Queen's Pawns regulars to picket the event. The demonstrators, all men, carried signs reading, "What good's king without a queen?" and "One man is worth 10 women?" None of the other women players supported Lane's campaign, which they viewed as unseemly. Lane and Gesser tied for the title, each winning 7 games and drawing 3. And that was the end of Lane's competitive career. She was just 33. She had grown tired of a cycle that repeated itself too often, being identified as a women's champion, having a man ask why tournaments were gendered, explaining the disparities in chess culture, and feeling obligated to defend herself and all women by playing the men who inevitably challenged her to a game. "I felt like I was working all the time," Lane said in the 2018 SI story. "I just couldn't put the title of women's chess champion on the line every time I sat down to play." But Lane was unsparing toward women players, too, who she said behaved like patrons of the game, not professionals. "The greatest enemies of women in chess are not men, but other women," she told the Times in 1972. These were women who were raised in a period when women considered themselves to be subservient to men. What money they won, they gave to the United States Chess Federation to sponsor other tournaments, mostly for men. Lane read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, became interested in environmentalism, and spent most of her time in rural Kent, an hour and a half north of the couple's apartment on Fifth Avenue. She opened a natural food store called Amber Waves of Grain, which she ran for more than 3 decades, and a gift shop, Earth Lore Gems and Minerals. "Hickey told me that while chess was enormously large in the arc of her life, Lane moved on happily from it. She loved her work, her dogs, her crewel embroidery, and socializing with local friends, including the illustrator Edward Sorrell and the former tennis player Renee Richards." Last year, Lane was inducted into the U.S. Chess Hall of Fame, which called her a pioneer in the development of women's chess. After retiring from tournaments, Lane played a few games in 1971 against an early chess program on an IBM System 360 Model 91 computer. She won every one. "I felt a genuine sense of confrontation and a tinge of disappointment when the computer failed to offer a word of congratulation upon resigning," Lane wrote in IBM's in-house magazine, Think. "It did not, at least, appear to resent losing to a woman, as do many human male players." This story was originally published in Slate. On the Talking Points page, NBC, Wyatt hired and fired McDaniel. NBC News' bold new Hire a Liar initiative didn't last long, said Jennifer Brooks in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Faced with a mass revolt by on-air talent, the network this week axed former Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel as a paid contributor, just days after signing her on a $300,000-a-year deal. NBC journalists were understandably outraged by the prospect of sharing a platform with an election denier who tore at the fabric of our democracy on the say-so of former President Donald Trump. On Meet the Press, the normally unflappable Chuck Todd blasted McDaniel, who once said NBC was a home for primetime propagandists, for credibility issues, and for subjecting the network's journalists to character assassination. On sister network MSNBC, Morning Joe co-host Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski vowed that McDaniel would never appear on their show, while Rachel Maddow likened her hiring to inviting a mobster to work at the DA's office. "Oh, spare us the sanctimony," said Jeffrey Blehar in National Review. "I don't recall the outrage when Jen Psaki went directly from being President Biden's press secretary to an NBC or when George Stephanopoulos, once a gleefully vicious hatchet man for President Bill Clinton, jumped to ABC. The only difference between those party hacks and McDaniel is that she's a Republican. The problem isn't McDaniel's party ID, said Lauren Stiller Rickleen in The Bulwark. It's her utter contempt for truth. She gleefully pushed Trump's voter fraud claims, personally tried to halt the certification of Biden's 2020 election win in Michigan, and sought to rebrand the January 6th Capitol riot as legitimate political discourse. In her first interview as a paid contributor on Meet the Press, McDaniel admitted she'd never really believed that Biden cheated in 2020 and that her rigging claims were just her taking one for the whole team. Clearly, McDaniel cannot be trusted to comment on future elections. This is a devilish moment for news organizations, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. Outlets that aim to understand Trump and the MAGA movement want to find voices that represent them. NBC hoped that McDaniel would fill that void, even though she was ousted from the RNC by Trump. But finding former insiders who still have links to Trump world, whose hiring won't outrage liberal viewers or journalists, and who can speak with intellectual honesty, is exceedingly difficult, if not inherently impossible. The McDaniel mess shows NBC hasn't solved the puzzle yet. No labels so far, no candidate. No Labels keeps searching for its dream third-party presidential ticket, said Vaughn Hilliard in NBCNews.com, but it keeps getting turned down. Amid concern that the organization's supposed unity ticket could serve as a spoiler and hand Donald Trump the election, more than a dozen political figures have declined invitations to be No Labels' presidential candidate, including former Representative Liz Cheney, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, and Senator Joe Manchin. Last week, even former Georgia Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, hardly a national household name, also said, no thanks. You'd think this would be easier, said Byron York in the Washington Examiner. Most Americans did not want a Joe Biden-Donald Trump rematch, and No Labels already has ballot access in 22 states. But widespread lack of interest has turned the organization's ambitious plans into something of a joke. In fact, No Labels is looking more like an elaborate gift, said Chris Brennan to USA Today. Founded in 2010 with noble intentions of promoting bipartisan cooperation in Congress, the organization insists it's not a political party. This has allowed it to keep its finances largely secret, but Politico revealed last year that Republican mega donor Harlan Crowe, Justice Clarence Thomas billionaire benefactor, was a major contributor, intensifying suspicions that the organization exists to siphon votes away from Biden. Meanwhile, its shady founders are raising millions in donations to pay themselves six-figure salaries, despite having no candidate. No third-party candidate, not Jill Stein, nor Cornel West, nor Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has much chance of winning, said Jeffrey Skelly in abcnews.go.com. But they could well affect the margins in closely divided swing states, which have been decided by as little as 10,000 votes in recent presidential elections. The Democrats' overwhelming focus is now on Kennedy, said Gabriel DeBenedetti in New York Magazine. RFK Jr., an anti-vax conspiracy theorist, is polling at about 12% in a matchup against Biden and Trump. Given Biden's relatively low approval ratings, Democrats believe the election needs to be a binary choice so they get every anti-Trump vote. As a result, spooked party operatives are challenging RFK Jr.'s petitions for ballot access in key swing states. If No Labels isn't on the ballot, it will be the black sheep of the Kennedy clan who poses the greatest threat to Biden. And we've got time for just a few short notes. E-commerce firms generated 3.4 billion pounds of plastic waste worldwide in 2021, an estimated 709 million pounds of which came from Amazon. While the retail giant says much of its packaging can be recycled, less than 5% of plastic packaging returned by customers to Amazon ends up at a recycling facility, according to an investigation by the nonprofit U.S. Public Interest Research Group. After 2 years of decline, average life expectancy in the U.S. rose by more than a year in 2022 to 77.5, two new CDC studies suggest. The bunch was largely a result of fewer COVID deaths. But life expectancy remains lower than before the pandemic, and a record 108,000 people died of drug overdoses in 2022, about 1,200 more than in 2021. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from Joyce Carol Oates, quoted in the Harvard Crimson. She says, "How far fewer words we need to tell our stories than we imagine we do." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.